This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Welcome. This hour, we'll sit down with the new secretary for the Pennsylvania Board of Pardons. Brandon Flood brings real-life experience to the job. He spent time behind bars as a younger man and recently received a pardon from Governor Wolf. We'll get Flood's perspective on the pardon process and what he thinks needs to change. Also, farmers and gardeners are gearing up to do battle with the spotted lanternfly, an invasive pest which is devastating timber and fruit crops in Pennsylvania and beyond. We'll get the latest on efforts to eliminate the lantern fly from Emily Swackhammer of the Penn State Extension. If you'd like to join the conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. To begin, the city of Philadelphia is making some real headway in its fight to stop illegal dumping, an unsightly, unsanitary, and expensive crime, which cost the city $1.5 million last year in cleanup costs. Philadelphia Streets Commissioner Carlton Williams joins us now to tell us more. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Mary. Thank you for having me.
So for anyone who hasn't experienced this, Carlton, give us a sense of what some areas in the city of what they have to contend with. Describe what an illegal dump typically looks like.
Sure. Illegal dumping is basically trash that is set out in a location that's not authorized for collection by the city of Philadelphia. It comes in various forms, from commercial constructing contractor debris to tires to household furniture and cleanouts. It's found in many of our most challenged communities where there's a lot of vacant, open, unused space, dark, desolate areas. And it ultimately impacts the quality of life in our local neighborhoods. It certainly affects commercial activity, and it can be a public health risk. So those are some of the challenges. It's also found in our parks and recreation centers, on our neighborhood corners. I mean, these are places where people come to live, work, and play, and unfortunately they're subjected to this type of illegal activity that does have a big impact on the quality of life of our neighborhoods and the morale of our communities.
I was just going to say, talk about morale. When somebody has to look out their back window to see what, a pile of tires and trash, and how high is the pile?
It's frustrating. I mean, we cleaned out literally at a location at 61st and Eastwick, which is a park area that has residential housing areas, over almost 20,000 tires that were dumped in the park area. And people were having multiple access points, and we finally made sure that we cleaned that area up. But the residents that had to live there and be subjected to that for a number of years, it was just really frustrating. So you know, the city had a concerted effort with PIDC. We cleaned it up. It cost the city, just for that cleanup alone, $30,000. I mean, these are the things that we're constantly chasing. So many people question, well, why don't you just continuously clean it up? But that's the problem. People think that you can just come in and it's okay to dump because the city's going to get it. We have to do things differently. And this is what we're working on this today with this initiative.
Who typically dumps illegally?
Well, there's a multiple range of people. You have your small clean-out contractor. You have your private businesses. You have residents, unfortunately, take their household trash and then start a pile of dumping. And see, that's a problem. When you take your trash and put it on a corner, other people see it and think it's okay. And the next thing you know, you have that tall pile of trash and then tires and then other debris. And once you start it, it's hard to stop because people then continuously repetitively go there. So that's why it's important not to address it immediately and not let it linger on.
And some of this stuff is hazardous. Tell us what cleanup crews, the street crews, have to contend with.
Yes, they have to deal with battery acid, oil containers, drums, a lot of contractor debris such as drywall and wood. You have house cleanouts such as old furniture, white metals and goods that often get dumped on the side of the road, mattresses, which is a huge issue. So those are the type of things that we're experiencing that we're dealing with each and every day.
And Carlton Williams, where does the discarded trash eventually end up? Just, is it landfilled?
We have multiple locations. We deal with landfills. We deal with waste-to-energy facilities. We have 6 drop-off centers, convenience centers, for the public to be able to utilize to bring some of this stuff. So there is options for people not to dump. if they just take the time and the effort to do so. But the private contractors obviously have a financial benefit, which they don't want to pay the hauling costs because they do have to get a private contractor. Our drop-off centers are made for citizens, residents, but private individuals have to pay for it, and they don't want to pay $600 to get it disposed of. They would rather just throw it on the side of the road and let the city take it. Mm-hmm. And that's where the taxpayers end up flipping the bill over $1.5 million just in the streets department collections alone.
As streets commissioner, what's your reaction?
Well, it's disgusting, number one, and it's frustrating because you have to constantly deal with it. The number of complaints that we receive every year and the locations. We have a place called, the Dirty 30, which is the most frequently dumped on locations. We'll clean it up one day. The next day, it's right back to the same condition. Mm. So that is extremely frustrating. But it's not something that we're giving up on. We're fighting it. We're being more proactive. Number one, we're using cameras.
This I was going to say, let's get to the positive news. So yeah. Cameras, tell us about the cameras.
Yeah, the cameras, the same cameras that our police department utilizes to catch criminals for illegal acts, we are now using to catch illegal dumpers. These cameras have night vision, which where it happens to occur most frequently.
Two or three in the morning.
We're able to get license plates numbers, which is important because evidence is key. We have to get the description of the vehicle, the person involved. All of those things are important because these are actual criminal cases, and we have to go in front of a court to prove that the person responsible actually committed the act so that we can hold them accountable. But once that occurs, we do have strict penalties, and we've increased the fines from $300 to $1,000 for the first offense. We can confiscate a vehicle. If it's a business, we can go after their business license through L&I, and ultimately we can get them to pay for the cost that taxpayers now have to flip. So those are important steps that we've taken.
So the charge is more serious now. It's no longer just a summary offense.
That's correct. It's now a misdemeanor through the district attorney's office, which means someone can carry a record and actually get jail time if the offense is so egregious enough that it warrants it. So I think that we're stepping up the enforcement. We've increased the strength of our laws. We've had better cooperation with our district attorney's office. We're so happy for our relationship with them for dedicating units for this. And we can't forget our police department, who helps us prosecute those cases as well. So it's really a strong partnership between law, government, and the public to address these issues.
So you've actually hired, or there are a couple of police detectives, environmental crimes detectives, who are specifically assigned to this?
That's correct, Mary. They're
so what do they do? Do they sit there and do they look at footage and that's what they do?
That's absolutely right. They look at
sense.
The footage. We give them the evidence from where we have monitors within the streets department. When we see a dumping occur, we have the ability to go back and record it. That's the evidence that we send to the police department, who then begins an investigation. They then track that person down until they actually catch them. They prepare the case, and it goes to court, to the district attorney's office, just like any other crime. So they're dedicated. We have a dedicated unit to that. It's not just a part of someone's other responsibilities. That's their sole job, to make sure that they track illegal dumpers.
We are speaking with Philadelphia Streets Commissioner Carlton Williams, and traditionally it has been tough to prosecute these illegal dumping cases without the cameras.
That's correct.
So are you seeing an increase in the number of prosecutions, arrests, convictions?
Absolutely. We had just alone this year, we had over 175 cases that we sent to the district attorney's office. 14 of them are actually going to the system. Now, you may not think 14 is a high number, but that is extremely great compared to what we've done in the past, which is virtually nothing. So these cases are being heard. They are being addressed. People are being held accountable. And I think that's the important part. But we know we need to do more. We know that the problem is much more widespread than 14 cases, and so we still need the public's help and support to report these incidents when they occur.
Are you seeing that are there fewer cases? I mean, you said the problem's still widespread, but are you seeing a lessening of it since the cameras and the publicity have been in place?
Yes. So we've had seen a decrease in areas that were frequently dumped upon. And I'm going to give you an example. We have a place off of Roosevelt Boulevard, the Logan Triangle. I mean, every day we would get thousands of tons. You would thought that it was legal. That's how much dumping that would occur. We installed 10 cameras at that location strategically throughout the neighborhoods and communities, and we're now seeing minimal dumping in those areas. They're still trying to be slick and go to hot spots or dark spots where they think they can't be seen, but we're catching them, but we're seeing less of it now. So that's a good sign. It's a good sign for the city. It's a good sign for the department and the neighborhoods in which these things were occurring.
So fines are up to $5,000, correct?
Yes.
And community service?
That's correct.
So what is that involved, you know?
So that is done by court order by a judge. So when a person is found guilty, they're forced to pay restitution. They could be fined up to $5,000. So the $5,000 is separate from them from the cleanup costs. And I gave you an example earlier today. That $31,000 would be those people who actually were caught doing that act. So they would have to pay the cost for what the city had to bear. They would have to pay the fine. And ultimately, they can also perform or have to clean up their own mess, which is what I like the most, is that you created it, so you need to clean it up in other people's mess so you won't do it again. Those are the things that I think that are being helpful and having an impact.
Carlton, so you mentioned that the city is asking for the public's help in a number of ways. So there's 311. Tell us more.
Yes. So when you see an act, something occurring in the act, you can actually call 911 for the police to actually get involved. Mm-hmm. Yes, because they can be arrested on the spot. So if you see someone actually doing it in the act and they have a huge amount of debris, and you call 911, police department will come out and make an arrest. So that's probably the most direct and most effective. If someone has dumped and you don't see them, but you want to report it, you can call 311. And 311 then starts the information of getting us the information in the streets department. We go out and do an investigation. We actually try to go through the trash to get an address. Those are some of the investigative tactics that we use. If we do, we roll back the video to see when it occurred and the time and the day specifically. And then that can start a case as well. So there's two direct ways in which you can actually get involved and help the streets department identify who these people are, track them down, and then make an arrest if we are able to get the information and evidence.
If you catch an illegal dumper in the act, no matter how angry you might be, count to 10,
that's
walk
right.
away after you call or
right.
take pictures, right?
Right. Remember, this is a crime. So the people are doing it usually don't have good values anyway. And we certainly don't want to put our public at harm or at risk by confronting someone who's out there illegal dumping, because then it may get confrontational, it may escalate, and we certainly don't want any injuries occurring. I know you may be angry, but the best way to do is to take matters in your hands is to call the police, call 911. If you have a cell phone from a safe distance, take a picture. Those are the things that can help the streets department address these things without having you worry about putting your safety in harm's way.
How much did the cameras cost?
The cameras cost actually about $6,000, including installation. Very high tech. We want to thank our Office of Information Technology and the police department for the installation of them. That's fiber optic, meaning they're connected to a network of photos. You can carry it on your cell phone, any web-based computer. We're working on actually technology that would ping us when a person comes into an area known for illegal dumping, and it will take a kind of a video description. The computer will then register it, and it will ping either the police department or our department right away so that we can get action.
Only have about 20 seconds left. We have a call from Alex who says, my daughter lives next to an empty lot that's about to be developed into condos. Who's responsible for keeping that lot clean? The developers?
Whoever is the property owner. So if it's the developer, they're responsible for maintaining that property in a clean and safe manner. So it's the owner of that property that's responsible
for it.
All
right, Carlton Williams, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us, Mary.
Carlton Williams is Commissioner of the Philadelphia Streets Department. Up next, Brandon Flood, Secretary for the Pennsylvania Board of Pardons. Stay with us. You are listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Our next guest recently assumed the job of secretary for the Pennsylvania Board of Pardons. It might be argued that Brandon Flood is distinctly qualified for the position. Flood himself was incarcerated in his early 20s, two felony convictions. But while behind bars, he began to change the course of his life. He had access to higher education, became interested in criminal justice reform and politics. And after his release, Flood sought and was eventually recently granted a pardon. He's now working to help reform what can be a convoluted and intimidating pardon process. And again, if you'd like to join us via social media, here's how. Send us an email to Radio Times at WHYY.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Brandon Flood, welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning, Mary. Thank you for having me.
So let's start at the beginning. Fair to say you had a straight and narrow upbringing, but rebelled as a kid?
Yeah, that's accurate. Certainly I was unique in that I was raised by a single father, college-educated, military man, National Guard. He was a state worker himself as well, comptroller for the Department of Health and Human Service, Health and Welfare. So I had all of the resources that many kids in the inner city, particularly men, black males of color, weren't afforded. And to your point, I kind of rebelled against that as a result.
So to make a long story short, you ended up behind bars in your early 20s. You'd been selling drugs. You had an unlicensed firearm. The writing could have been on the wall, I guess, when you were sent to the state correctional facility at Chester. But instead, the writing was found in college level courses.
Right. Yeah. College level courses, as well as just being actively engaged while incarcerated. For anyone who has not been incarcerated themselves, you can easily become distracted with television, cards, and basketball, and next thing you know, your minimum sentence is up, and you go home without much personal development. But Chester was unique in having a lot of nonprofit entities, community based organizations, academic institutions of higher learning come in and really engage us and broaden our horizons. So for me, that came in the form of debate courses, writing workshops, emceeing, and just understanding the power of the spoken and written word.
The autobiography of Malcolm X meant a lot?
Right. Yes, definitely was one of the most transformative pieces of literature that I've ever come across. That was the first example that I was able to see where someone was able to transform their life, someone with similar circumstances, really not only transform his life to positively impact his immediate community, but to ultimately have a global impact. So for me, that was an example that I intended to follow upon my release.
And so, Brandon Flood, for you, then Harrisburg and politics was the next step after you were released?
Right. Yeah, I guess I had the good fortune of being from the city of Harrisburg, particularly for state government, the hub of state government. So I knew that there would be some opportunities there. Initially, I was looking for an opportunity on the local level in the city. But fortunate for me, I had some colleagues that worked for the legislature and extended me an internship opportunity, which I reluctantly took. But upon acceptance, it really created an opportunity for a great degree of upward mobility for me professionally.
For people, though, who are coming out of prison, if you have a criminal record, there can be some big roadblocks hindering that next step. Tell us more.
Right. Yeah. No, I think the stat is, and I believe it's the American Bar Association that cites that for a criminal conviction can be up to 40,000 different collateral consequences. So in my particular case, while I had the good fortune where my background really didn't stop me too many times, I think maybe once it came up and became a hindrance for an employment opportunity. But for many people, it certainly is. It does present a huge hurdle for me. Luckily, like I said, with the House of Representatives, despite having that conviction, they brought me on as an intern. And then from there, once I began to apply for other positions, I didn't have to revisit that criminal history question, and I moved around quite a bit. So I was able to get a lot of experience under my belt before that criminal history question was raised again. And that's once I left the legislature for employment.
Brandon Flood is secretary for the Pennsylvania Board of Pardons. He is with us for the next 10 minutes or so here on WHYY Radio Times. So, Brandon, what made you then decide to seek a pardon, and what was the process like?
As you mentioned at the top of this segment, very intimidating when I first began to peruse. I actually what was was beneficial for me, because I was actually working on clemency reform when I was the executive director of the Pennsylvania Black Caucus. So I was more familiar than the average person was with how things worked administratively and statutorily. So that helped to help me to overcome some of the more daunting and arcane pieces of that process that most people encounter. So initially I put in, at that time we had a more rigorous standard, whereas if you made one clerical error on your application, the board had the right to reject your application and you start back over. And that's what happened for me. I made one clerical error, they rejected my application, and I actually let a year and a half go by before I put back in, because I was kind of disenchanted with the process and said, you know what, do I really need a pardon? I've been able to do things, been able to navigate pretty well professionally, but at the behest of actually a former Secretary of Board of Pardons, and then my desire to seek public office as well, that really got me to thinking, second guessing whether or not I should put in. So I put back in. It took about 3.5 years before I got
years.
A public. Yeah, 3.5 years. We now have it down to 2.5 years. We're slowly but surely going to reduce that turnaround time. There's a few things that we can do from a policy standpoint that I think would really get us to that point.
So we'll get to that in just a moment, but a moment or two. But so when the record was wiped clean for you, Brandon Flood, what was the feeling like?
Yes, I usually get that question. For me, it really was just like another day for me. I felt like I was able to, I was able to do pretty well professionally, and it really didn't come up. I can count on one hand how many times it came up or served as a hindrance, and being familiar with state law and the Criminal History Record Information Act. And I was more informed about what records employers could use and state agencies could use, as opposed to the average layman or laywoman. So for me, it really didn't change much, actually. For me, it just felt like it was another day.
Well, for other, I'm not sure, if you're working with people who are still in the prison system, but I would guess that for some it would be like turning a page, moving forward, closing
right,
the chapter.
No. For some, especially those that are looking to pursue specific career paths that they either are statutorily barred from pursuing, or that the conviction serves to preclude them from being able to avail themselves of those opportunities. Yet this, it's a game changer for them. And I do still regularly, in addition to having pardon clinics out on, in various locales, I'm also going to, my goal is to go to each state correctional institution. I've been to 3 so far, and letting the incarcerated population know upon their release, hey, here's what this landscape exists, first and foremost. Here's what it consists of. And certainly, as the old commercial, the Hair Club for Men commercial, and I'm not only the president, I'm also a client. Mm-hmm. So I can say, hey, I actually went through this process myself and was successful.
What are the factors that go into determining whether someone is deserving of a pardon or a reduction in sentence?
Right. So the board looks at a number of factors. Certainly they look at the nature or the severity of the crime, whether you had a direct victim who may have been harmed, whether physically or whether financially. They also look at how much time has elapsed since the conviction or since the applicant's release from prison. They really look at they want to see demonstrable evidence that you have rehabilitated yourself, or you've given back to your community, or if you've turned that corner. So,
and what might that be?
That may be something even personal development, maybe getting a degree, a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, maybe volunteerism. It may be serving on boards. It can be a number of things. That really would demonstrate that not only are you looking to improve and edify yourself, but you're also giving back to your community. So for me, while I didn't have that much time that had elapsed from the time I was released, I had a lot of I was able to counterweight that with a lot of professional development, a lot of personal development. So a number of positions that I occupied, a number of boards that I had served on, a number of initiatives that I could speak directly to. Those are some of the things that they look at. Also, fines and costs as well. So if anyone has any outstanding court costs or fees, restitution. Certainly they want that to be paid down. And then more importantly, look at if the individual accepts responsibility for the crime, the part they played in it, and to see whether or not that person has, if they exhibit some compunction for that crime.
This leads to the next question. Some critics will say, well, how do you ensure that an offender whose pardon doesn't offend again, who is pardoned and then doesn't go out and offend again? I mean, especially if there might have been a victim involved in a particularly tough crime.
Well, yeah, you know, and one of the things I talked about, the severity of the crime, and if there's a direct victim, certainly by law we are required to notify victims of any applicant that receives a public hearing, and the victim has an opportunity to weigh in either in support or in opposition to the application. You know, so it is a pretty high standard, and the board merely recommends clemency application to the governor. So you have essentially you have six gatekeepers, if you will, and certainly the governor does not have to follow that recommendation. He can certainly exercise his discretion and whether or not he believes that the applicant is deserving. We also have a process where we can issue what are called conditional pardons, and usually the condition is not to reoffend. That essentially the board reserves the authority to bring that individual back before the board to assess, especially if they were convicted of a subsequent crime, whether or not to rescind or revoke that pardon. So there's some mechanisms in place that certainly we can use, and certainly when anyone puts in for clemency, it's a very high standard.
You work closely with Pennsylvania's victim advocate Jennifer Storm. What's that relationship like?
It was a relationship I had before I even put in for my own pardon. I understand, especially working in the field of politics and understanding what goes into the development of public policy, you need to make sure all stakeholders have input and are invited to the table. So that was something I learned early on, and especially when we talk about criminal justice reform, certainly one side of that coin is the reentrant or the justice involved person, but it's important that we also recognize and remember that on the flip side of that coin are also victims who deserve their say and certainly deserve to be made whole. So Jennifer respected that about me years ago, and certainly increased the amount of respect and admiration, and it goes both ways. It's only increased over the years.
Our guest is Brandon Flood. He is secretary for the Pennsylvania Board of Pardons. So, Brandon, for those in the system who are challenged in their efforts to seek clemency, what is the starting point? What needs to change in the process?
Well, one of the things that I've seen, and I probably see every week, is I'm able to identify inefficiency. And usually the question I ask is, why do we do this? Do we have to do this? Are we required by law to do this? We've been around since 1872, and there are quite a few processes that we undertake that derive from the 19th century, so just trying to think outside of the box and look at different ways of doing things. So the first thing I would say, and what's priority number one for me, is fully digitizing our online filing and information exchange processes. We're very much a paper-based agency, which certainly needs to change. We're not leveraging the technology that's at our fingertips in 21st century. Being able to fully digitize the online filing and that information exchange, and our information exchange systems, will allow us to speak to other agencies more efficiently that we're required to for this process. And also will allow us to cut that wait time in half.
The wait time can be intimidating for somebody who's waiting to get their life started.
Right. Usually when someone asks me how long it takes and I say 2.5 years, you can kind of see in their eyes, despair, and a lot of folks are looking for more immediate relief. So the one thing I would tell people, at least currently, is, hey, this is something that is not going to be an immediate fix. We try to provide resources that they can avail themselves in the meantime of while they wait for the pardon. Or the clemency application. But I usually tell people once you fill it out and once you submit it, it's kind of like set it and forget it. So you're better off, what's the saying, you're better off wearing a raincoat in the event it rains than not having one. So I usually tell people you're better off putting in for the pardon, and you'll probably forget about it until which time it's time for the schedule you for a hearing. So just understand, the first thing that people need to understand is it does not provide immediate relief. But it is an investment in yourself, and at the end of the day, it's an investment that certainly potentially will allow you to restart your life again. It's a worthwhile investment.
Also, a $63 application fee is gone, and I'm guessing that was a deal breaker for some people.
Right. For some people, I know a lot of people say, well, $63 isn't a lot of money, but for something that's not considered a guarantee, something that does not provide immediate relief, and we're actually in the process of doing a study to see the impact that pardons have on economically depressed communities. For some people, $63 means a great deal, you know. So for some people, if they had to weigh that option, I can put the $63 towards a light bill or something else, they would opt for that. So removing that fee, certainly we've seen, and we've already seen it bear itself out. More people have applied as a result, and then it's less steps as a result of removing that fee. People don't have to get their criminal record from state police anymore, or the driver record anymore up front. So it definitely lessens it makes it more convenient for the applicant, both financially and I guess time and energy wise.
Brandon, what do you want to accomplish in your time as Secretary of the Pennsylvania Board of Pardons?
I would say it's real simple. I think there's a significant number of people who have who would be more compelling applicants than I was, who should be putting in for this process and restarting their lives, but either due to lack of knowledge, misinformation, or just a reluctance to engage. They aren't taking advantage of this program. So get as many people that are eligible as possible to look at clemency as a viable option to start their lives over.
What do you think of the job? Are you enjoying it?
Oh, yeah. You know, I understand this isn't a Supreme Court appointment, so this isn't a lifetime gig. So I'm making the most of it. You know, I'm grinding hard and trying to partner with any and all organizations to get the word out about what we're doing. And also, you know, I'm trying to be non-traditional as secretary of this agency. I'm trying to wade into other waters as it relates to criminal justice reform. Because, you know, if we're able to address some of those front end issues, the less people that are coming to see us on the back end. So, yeah, definitely busy. And I'm looking forward to working with the lieutenant governor to make sure more people know about what we do.
It was a pleasure.
Advantage.
Thank you so much for joining us. Brandon Flett is secretary for the Pennsylvania Board of Pardons. Up next on Radio Times, we talk about the spotted lantern fly and efforts to eradicate it. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It's being called the worst invasive pest since the gypsy moth was brought to this country 150 years ago. The spotted lanternfly is a large, odd-looking, messy, and extraordinarily destructive insect which has been wreaking havoc on area plants, trees, and crops since it first showed up in Berks County 5 years ago. Since then, the spotted lanternfly has been on the move. Over a dozen counties are now in quarantine in Pennsylvania. Delaware has enacted a partial quarantine. New Jersey's on guard, and as federal and state researchers try to figure out how to squash the lanternfly's advance, home gardeners are being recruited as part of the resistance. Emily Swaghammer is with the Penn State Horticulture Extension, and she joins us now. Welcome, Emily.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
We're great. We're very happy to have you here. Tell us more about this insect. Where did it come from?
The lanternfly is native to parts of Asia, so China, Vietnam, mostly southeastern Asia. And it's not really so much of a problem there, but it was recently introduced into South Korea, where it became a big problem. And then we found it here in 2014.
So it looks kind of like maybe a Frankenbug, little bits and pieces of like maybe a moth. And then it's got a yellow one and black striped abdomen, which makes it seem as if there's a little bit of a bee to it. Tell us about this insect. What does it look like? How big is it? And what are its habits?
Yeah, so it looks different in its different life stages. When it's in its young stage right now, it's black with white spots.
And so that's the nymph stage?
The nymph stage. Yeah. And they can jump really far. They feed on the tender parts of plants, so on the tender new growth and the undersides of leaves. In a couple weeks, they'll start transitioning into their last nymphal stage, and they develop this beautiful red coloration. And they're half an inch longer, so they're getting bigger and bigger all the time. And then when they turn into adults, they're about an inch long. They're a plant hopper, so they're not a moth or, you know, in that family. But when they sit on the plants, they have their wings down over their backs. And if you see pictures of this, it's a pretty easy one for the public to identify. There's nothing else that really looks like it here.
If you could, for radio again, give us a complete description. So there's red and there's brown and there are black spots and there's also yellow and black stripes.
Yeah, so the adults, the wings are kind of a mauvey color with very distinct black spots. And the ends, the tips of those top wings have a black netting pattern. And when they're disturbed, they'll display their underwings and they have a red and black pattern to them. And then as the females develop eggs, they kind of get fatter and fatter, and you see this yellow coloration on their abdomens.
Okay. So back to what they do to inflict damage. They actually pierce the plants to get sap, and they're really messy, too. Tell us about that.
They have piercing, sucking mouth parts, so they don't chomp the foliage or make holes in the foliage. They will pierce through it, and you don't really see the hole where that piercing mouth part goes in. It's almost like a tiny straw they insert into the plant. And then they start to withdraw the sap. And as they're withdrawing the sap, they're taking more sap into their bodies than they really need. So they excrete partially digested tree sap out the other end. We call that affectionately honeydew. It has a lot of sugars left in it from the plant photosynthesis. And when the honeydew deposits on anything underneath, sooty mold grows on that, so a black, moldy, really a complex of mold organisms. But that can make a real mess of landscapes and decks and patios and cars.
And it destroys plants, particularly the vineyards. Local vineyards are really struggling with
right.
this.
Right. So we're very concerned about our vineyards. We've had cases where lots of lantern flies, when they become adults and they can fly, have flown into vineyards and fed on the woody parts of the vines, and then those grapes, the vines didn't really make it through the winter as well as they should have. So we're concerned that they're pulling the energy out of the plants and then reducing their health and leaving them susceptible to secondary invaders and damage from winter conditions and things like that.
Where does the quarantine extend?
The quarantine is in 14 counties in Pennsylvania. So it goes as far out as Dauphin County, as far north as Carbon and Monroe, and then Philadelphia County, Delaware County. The whole extreme southeastern corner of Pennsylvania is in that quarantine.
And a little bit of Delaware, I think.
A little bit of Delaware.
Delaware's on guard, and so is New Jersey. Some have been found in northwestern Jersey, correct?
Three counties in New Jersey are under quarantine as well. There's some in northern Virginia in one county, and they're known to be in northern Maryland as well.
And this all started just 5 years ago in Berks County, so the spread has been pretty quick.
Right. They definitely can move around. Under their own steam, they don't move further than a few kilometers a year or a couple miles. But the big danger is that people move them without realizing it. And if you move an egg mass, they're hard to see. If you move that egg mass, there's about 30 to 50 eggs per egg mass, and you can start a whole new population just by moving something without realizing you're doing it.
What does the egg mass look like?
Yeah, so the female lays her eggs in rows, and they look like tiny little jelly beans lined up next to each other, and then she'll cover them with a secretion from her body that dries down to look like a splooch of mud. They're cryptic. They're hard to see on rough surfaces, on tree bark, but they can be laid on any solid object, so rocks, picnic benches, firewood for sure, construction materials, really any solid object. So we really want people to inspect things and clean off any insect egg masses before they move those objects and not move things around like firewood. There's other insect pests that get moved around that way, so it's a good practice all around.
So that's part of the quarantine.
That's part of the quarantine.
It sounds like a heavy lift, though. I mean, going, looking, you know, at your firewood, your cars, and et cetera. I mean, is it practical?
Well, getting the information out to the public is the real key, and you're helping us with that today. In South Korea, they didn't try to respond in the way that we're responding here, and it spread across the whole country in 3 years. And the country landmass of South Korea is very similar to the landmass of Pennsylvania. So we're trying to be optimistic that we're containing it and trying to give the researchers time to catch up to it and come up with better management methods.
Let's talk about the damage in the millions. The threat is billions.
Yeah, and we don't have a good estimate of that yet. We're learning all the time, but it's hard to sort out how much damage is happening exclusively from lanternfly as opposed to combination factors. We are interested, though, if the public sees damage from the lanternfly, they can call me at the Montgomery County Extension Office. I am looking for cases of that. We are getting documentation of damage in vineyards, but we're really looking for it on ornamental trees, and we're working with our nursery producers to try to quantify that. But it's just not an easy thing to quantify.
Emily Swackhammer is horticulture educator for the Penn State Extension. She's joined us for the rest of the hour here on Radio Times. The spotted lanternfly actually prefers a plant called the Tree of Heaven, which is not native to the U.S. Is right. That an invasive as well?
Tree of Heaven is an invasive tree here. It was brought here originally because it's a tough tree and it is kind of pretty, and people thought it would be a good tree to have here, so it was brought here from Asia. It has naturalized across the country. I came down on the train today and I saw lots of Tree of Heaven along the way. It likes disturbed areas. It will come up in along roadsides. And the lanternfly loves that tree. It kind of makes sense. It's a tree from Asia, so, you know, it's familiar to the insect.
Yeah. So, but if you have one, then
right. We're hoping that people try to get rid of the Tree of Heaven. And they're difficult to remove. If you just cut it down, it will re-sprout from the trunk and the root system. And the root system sprouts might be 20, 30, 40 feet away from the main trunk. So you really have to be vigilant at it. You can keep cutting them back, and eventually you might win because there's a lot of strength in those root systems. But people are also using herbicides that translocate and move to the root system to kill them. And you need to know how to do that properly. We have a lot of information on the Penn State website that can help you.
There are no natural predators in the United States to the spotted lanternfly?
That's something that I've heard people talk about, but actually there are. So I'm glad to be able to tell everybody about that. We know that general predators like spiders and praying mantids and the wheel bugs will eat them. We don't think that they're causing a great decrease in the population. But we also know that there are some tiny parasitic wasps, and these wasps are like 1 millimeter long. They're so tiny you would hardly even notice that they're there. But they will lay their eggs inside the egg of the lanternfly, and then as the wasp hatches, it will kill the lanternfly egg. We've seen some evidence of this happening with wasps that already exist in Pennsylvania. There are also researchers from the United States Department of Agriculture exploring in China and the lanternfly's native range to try to bring possibly a natural predator like this here.
But do you want to import another?
That's about a 10-year process. You really have to. You have to think about how difficult this research is to imagine every kind of possible consequence and then come up with an experiment to test that. So these are really smart people that are trying to put the pieces together, but it will be many years if that ever does transpire. The other biological thing that's out there that has been knocking them back, there are two fungi that are naturally occurring in Pennsylvania. And last year, with all the rainy weather, you know how fungi really loves wet?
Yes, we do.
Yeah. So we saw death of a lot of lanternflies caused by these two different fungi. And we are looking at that as a potential biological control for the future.
All right, we've got some calls and comments coming into Radio Times. Melissa says, I'm an assistant director at a wildlife center, and we use lanternfly paper to catch the flies, but we notice it's also killing non-target species like hawks and squirrels.
Melissa is asking a great question. One of the mechanical methods that people are using to kill lanternflies is a sticky band of paper. It's like fly paper. They wrap it around the trunks of trees, and then the lanternfly, especially nymphs, will fall out of the trees. They crawl back to the trunks. They crawl up the trunk, and they get stuck on the sticky paper. You can catch thousands of lanternflies with this method, but it has a major drawback that you can catch unintended creatures.
A hawk and a squirrel.
I've seen pictures. We know this is happening. We have a new fact sheet on the Penn State website that gives some suggestions to try to reduce this possibility. Nobody wants this to happen. You can build a guard of chicken wire around the cages or around the bands to try to keep other creatures off. If you use a very narrow strip of the sticky paper, it will fill up from the bottom as the lanternflies climb up the trees, and then you don't have all that exposed sticky surface at the top above it where another creature could get entangled.
Sure.
But, I mean, if people want to use sticky bands, they have to go into that with their eyes wide open that this doesn't happen very often, but when it does, it's not fun for anybody.
We have a tweet which says, my husband believes he saw a lantern fly in our garden 2 days ago, but he didn't realize what it was until he saw a photo of it last night. What should we do?
Okay, we do want people to report that they're finding the lantern fly. We know that they're throughout Berks County and, you know, the central part of the infestation area, but especially in the peripheral areas into Philadelphia County, Delaware County. And you can report them by going to the Penn State website. There's an online reporting feature. You can also call 1-888-4-BAD-FLY. And you can.
It has its own number?
It does. It's a Penn State number that we set up. We have people that man that during the day, and they'll take your report. And they can also talk to you about management methods if that's what you want information on.
We'll also post some pictures of the adult, the nymph, and I think they probably the egg mass, too, if we can get them up.
Yes.
So that people can recognize them.
We'll post them.
So no mercy if you're a backyard gardener. If you see any of these creatures.
Right. So the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture does have a quarantine order in place. And part of that quarantine order states that the property owner should try to kill these insects. We're trying to control them, reduce their numbers, and not spread them anywhere else. You can decide what your comfort level is. If it's a fly swatter and mechanical methods, use those methods. There are insecticides that will work. We're only suggesting that people use real insecticides that you would purchase at a garden center rather than mixing up some kind of recipe that you know heard about.
So not a bucket of soap and water?
Yeah, because you can hurt the plants that you're trying to protect. And some of the products that people have been using are actually dangerous for the people. So use something like insecticidal soap or neem oil, products that are known to be insecticides, and they have labels and directions and follow all of the safety precautions.
So that was the next question. How do you, what's the best way to get rid of the spotted lanternfly without destroying beneficial insects?
Yeah, I would stick with one of those two products, probably insecticidal soap. As soon as it dries, there's no residual activity. So if a pollinator insect comes into the area after that, it wouldn't hurt that other insect. There are other insecticides that can be used. But I would start with the soft products first. And if you really have, you know, a huge nuisance problem and a big tree, you might consider working with a landscape professional, somebody that's licensed, knows proper ways to use insecticides. They're going to use the safety precautions. Don't expose yourself to that risk if you can at all help it.
Does a really cold winter kill them off?
We know there's been some mortality of the eggs from winter conditions, but we don't really have that quantified well. We don't have any hope that a severely cold winter will eradicate this insect from our area. We think it's here for now until we can come up with better management methods, hopefully between the biological controls and, you know, some of the insecticide work that's going on. Maybe we can come up with smarter, better methods and hopefully get rid of it someday. But even if we had those methods now, that's a process that takes many years.
And this is not a stinging insect, right?
No, it doesn't sting or bite people.
But it does, it can swarm?
Well, they will gather on the trees where they're feeding, and they can be a real nuisance in backyards. And they're not shy of people. They will jump on you. So if you have somebody in your family that's really afraid of insects, that can be traumatic for people. They're a big insect and, you know, kind of friendly.
Well, we're not supposed to be friendly back.
No.
That's the key. Just
try to swat
because
them.
Because it's enormously destructive. So again, Emily, that number?
1-888-4-BAD-FLY.
And thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Emily Swackhammer is horticulture educator with the Penn State Extension. Best of luck to you in this endeavor. Remember to check us out on social media and our podcasts as well. It's all at WHYY.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today was Diana Martinez. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.